This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for thinking of the people of Oklahoma City and its surrounding communities today. These are places I know well. On April 19, 1995, I flew on a chartered network jet into a stormy Oklahoma City hours after the bombing of the federal building by Timothy McVeigh, a terrorist attack that killed 168 people, injured more than 650. It seemed then, as now, that the city was just too small to absorb such a blow. And almost exactly 4 years later, on May 4, 1999, I flew in another chartered jet into Oklahoma City through serious jaw-dropping turbulence hours after a series of tornadoes of force 3, 4, and 5 clawed through the metro area, flattening block after block. I saw nails sucked through 2-inch boards, splintered houses, concrete foundations that looked as though they'd been polished clean by some kind of machine. I saw the faces of grieving families. 5 people died then, more than 100 were injured. Then, as now, it seemed these communities were just too small. Moore, Shawnee, Newcastle, Bridge Creek, too small to absorb the blow. And now this, on a scale far beyond what folks saw in 1999, a persistent pattern of storms that was already deadly 2 days ago, and then yesterday it turned into a powerful cluster of tornadoes never before seen here, carving a huge path of destruction near to where the 1999 storms passed, a step back into grief for the people of Oklahoma City, an 18-year-long journey for so many of these folks, a terror and grief revisited today.
Please know that we're working as quickly as we can. There are a tremendous amount of people that are helping. For those who aren't involved in rescue operations, please stay away from the immediate vicinity. Early in the afternoon, when I saw the tornado hitting this area, I called out 80 of our National Guard members to come and help secure the perimeters and to also help our highway patrol with our traffic congestion on our highways and to secure the areas that have been affected.
Dealing with the grief and the chaos, that's Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon responding to a disaster that began days ago in infrastructure that has crumbled.
Right now, there's power out to about 39,000 people still in the area across the state, and water is an issue in that area, as well as phone service.
That's Nate Webb of the Oklahoma Office of Emergency Management. The witnesses describe what they've seen in a tone that really conveys they still can barely believe it.
Well, a tornado just hit a few minutes ago. It was very close by. I don't know if you can see this, but here's a truck that is just completely wrapped around a tree. The truck is folded over like a spoon. Apparently they're hearing some voices from underneath.
That man came from a neighboring town to help people with the wreckage in Moore, Oklahoma, destroyed once again, a community where the schools were in harm's way, and that may be where the grief and loss may end up being the greatest.
The tornado went in, and I was so afraid that I was hanging on to one of the desks, and then I fell back, and then all the dirt started getting in my eyes and all my clothes.
That unidentified child speaking to KWTV was in school when the tornado hit. 2 schools in Moore are completely destroyed. Pictures very upsetting. Eradicated neighborhoods, 10 and 20 blocks square, homes, buildings, schools, ground to rubble. A lot of our listeners have reached out. Mel wrote on our Facebook page, "Everyone is numb here. We're 100 miles away, praying for everyone who is affected by severe weather in the past few days." Eric told us, "Finally heard from my aunt and cousin. My cousin lost some windows, but my aunt's house is almost completely gone." And of course, we are praying for all of the folks, our listeners, people who have contacted us, people who have been lucky and others not so lucky. Joining us now, Rachel Hubbard, Associate Director at KOSU. She joins us from Oklahoma City. Rachel, numb is a word we could use to describe today.
It is. It's a very surreal scene. I've seen tornado damage before, but this is unlike anything that I've ever seen.
And you visited one of the schools in Moore that was completely devastated. Describe that scene.
Well, it took us quite some time to get there yesterday after the tornado, but when we finally arrived, you couldn't even tell that this was a school. The playground equipment was crumpled beyond recognition. The houses closest to Plaza Towers Elementary School were wiped clean off the foundation. The only thing that was left were water pipes that were still spewing water because the city hadn't had time to turn it off yet. And people were just standing outside of this makeshift caution tape that was put up with splinters of houses. That was what it was tied to, and the corner of a beam that had been, a steel beam that had been ripped out of the elementary school and jammed into the ground by the force of the tornado. And it looked like the school had been bombed, and firefighters were pulling rocks out one at a time and passing them down a line, just trying to get to the people who are still trapped.
And did you see any reunions, people recognizing each other? Part of what's so disorienting is not only do you not know where you are, people are unrecognizable after all of this devastation.
Well, it was just an insane scene, and I don't trying to give people a way to understand it. It looks like a zombie movie. People are just walking around, sort of with these blank stares. Some of them are dragging small suitcases along behind them, and they have their pets on leashes. And this is literally all that is left of their lives.
And these are the lucky ones.
These are the lucky ones. They're continuing to pull survivors out of storm shelters that are so buried by rubble that they don't even know that these storm shelters that many people put in their garages are even exist. So they're continuing to look for those. And then there is this elementary school, which is the epicenter of the devastation.
I've heard, again, the numbers are moving all over the map here, but you know, more than 100 pulled alive over the last 18 hours or so. How are you doing, Rachel?
Well, it's as I sat with my husband last night attempting to eat dinner late in the night, it was we just talked about trying to come back to reality because the scene was so horrific that I really had no way to process the information that I had seen. And it's hard for us coming in as people who don't live in that neighborhood, and it's even harder for the people who are there and they're disoriented and they have no idea what has just happened.
Well, I can still remember walking those streets of Moore, Oklahoma, back in 1999 and seeing just the street signs. Rachel Hubbard is Associate Director at KOSU, speaking to us from Oklahoma City. Rachel, stay with us. We're going to bring Pastor Ben Glover, a minister at the Oak Crest Church of Christ in Oklahoma City. Pastor, welcome. Are you there?
I am. Thank you very much.
You've been really, I mean, all the churches in the communities there become first responders, in a sense, opening your doors. So what's going on there at the church?
You're absolutely right. It's wonderful to see everybody pulling together and all the different churches just reaching out. Here at Oak Crest, we have opened our doors really to kind of short-term, long-term goals. Short-term, we have folks who are coming in who just need water, food, shelter. We processed about 60, 70 folks yesterday looking for information, looking for those basic needs, trying to find a place to land. Last night we had about 20 folks who stayed the night, folks who had no home to go back to. So kind of our short-term goals are to reach those needs. Long-term goals are to help them over the next weeks and months to kind of put their lives back together.
I could hear that your phone is working. That's something to be grateful for, Pastor Glover. Our colleague Rachel Hubbard was describing just how much seeing the school in Moore has affected her, trying to figure out a way of processing what's going on with her and with the others in the community. I wonder if you could give her a little help here. She's on the line with us.
Sure. One of the wonderful things of being back here and working on this side of it and not being in the middle of it is hearing the phone calls. One of the things that I would process is, as much devastation as we have seen yesterday, all day long we kept receiving calls from our city, our state, the country, and even internationally. People calling and saying, hey, we want to help. We want to send this, or do you need workers or money, or what can we do to help? And it does bring you back to reality, as Rachel said. It helps to kind of center you that, as devastating as this is to humanity, there's also really incredibly good folks out there who really care and who want to reach out to these families that are numb and lost and hurting. And so there's wonderful places. Oakcrest here is doing it, but there's churches and organizations all around those folks. And our prayer is that they'll just be able to reach out and find the emotional and psychological, spiritual, physical needs that they need met. There are folks who are just waiting, literally looking for something to do. So it's such a good feeling to know that it's not all just hopeless. We hurt for those with loss, and especially those who don't even know right now whether their homes are there or not. And we know that's a tragedy, and we really hurt for them. But they're not alone, and there are resources and folks ready and waiting to make a difference in their lives.
Rachel, are you hearing that message? And describe for us for a moment to just how experienced the Emotional Response Network is there in Oklahoma City.
Well, it was so wonderful yesterday across from the school just to be able to share in a positive emotion. They had searched the remnants of these homes for hours and hours, and there was a couple there, and they had been away at work, and their dog was left behind in the home. And after hours, when it seemed hopeless, the little dog was found, and it had climbed behind the couch. And everybody that was in that neighborhood clapped and cheered, and we cried together and hugged. And it was a small amount of joy in the middle of complete devastation. And it was, you know, even compared to moments of joy that are of great magnitude, that thing that probably in comparison was considerably small was the most joy that the people around me and I, when we talked about it, said that we had experienced in quite some time.
Pastor Glover, what's the concern going forward over the next several days as the continuing needs of the community compound?
Oh, absolutely. That's a great question. I think so often what happens in situations like this is we get a good spotlight, and again, I will say I appreciate so much the media for doing a great job of spotlighting our little corner of the world. This is a tragedy, and this is a huge need, but obviously that spotlight can't stay there forever. There'll be other things going on in the world that need also to be seen and witnessed. Our problem here will be folks will need to put their lives together and put their homes, lives, and families back together, and that will take weeks, months, maybe years. And so it's an ongoing process. So we know as churches and organizations in this area, because of May of 1999, that this is a process and a journey. And so you take it a step at a time, and we have the resources, the people lining up. And so you begin with the basic needs, and you know the power companies are out there and the water company, and then you move into helping folks rebuild. It's just a step-by-step process, and it really takes a whole community. And this is a great community. It's strong. It's vibrant. It shows that it can bounce back. And there are a lot of people here who really want to help. So, you know, we really look forward to the rebuild. Again, hurt for those who are hurting today, because there's just, you know, there are folks out there who've been devastated, and there will be no easy way today. But we just pray and hope in the future that maybe we can be a part of the healing process.
Well, Pastor Glover, thanks so much. Minister at Oakcrest Church of Christ in Oklahoma City, just north of Moore, Oklahoma. Rachel Hubbard, you take care now.
Thank you.
Rachel Hubbard is Associate Director at KOSU, speaking to us from Oklahoma City. We're on this. You know how you can reach us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Stay with us here on The Takeaway. We return now to the recovery in Oklahoma City and the communities of Grady, Cleveland, and McLean counties. They're all devastated. The rescue is still going on. The task of rebuilding continuing. For a better sense of the emergency response in a situation like this, we turn to someone experienced in disaster relief, Garrett Ingolia, Vice President of Emergency Response at AmeriCares. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, John.
What's the scale of this disaster? And we're starting to see it, but the aerial pictures really only tell part of the story.
Yeah, it's devastating, and as you say, we're still learning more about the true extent of the destruction, but it is truly a devastating event. A huge storm, you know, almost 2 miles wide, winds in excess of 200 miles an hour. You hear the death tolls climbing. It's truly a massive, catastrophic event.
And it's going to take days for any of those numbers to settle down to what we will know as the history of this devastating storm. In terms of the forces at work here, I remember the 1999 event that had force fives, force fours, force threes. It was a series of a cluster of tornadoes. This is a cluster, but it's also a string of storms that's been going on for days.
Yeah, so it's been a very calm tornado season up until the last 48 hours, and then as we've seen, it's been terrible in Kansas and Missouri and Oklahoma, and then especially this one very severe tornado that swept through Newcastle and more in the Oklahoma City area. And this is, you know, certainly the worst tornado since the 2011 season, which was historic.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the unique problems in this community. The transportation disruption has made the rescue and recovery effort and simply getting people to hospitals a real challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. The debris that's blocking roads is a serious problem. The fact that the Moore Medical Center has been damaged and people have been evacuated is a real serious issue. And just the number of homes that have been destroyed, the extent of the damage, it all adds up to a very difficult situation. And the winds are so strong that it's very difficult to get people out of the rubble, and there's real concern that, that people in there are not going to be able to survive. So it is a unique set of challenges. I mean, if you look at the aerial footage, you'll see just wide swaths of these communities that are just destroyed, and as you say, roads that are impassable. So it's going to be a real challenge to help the victims and then to deal with all of the people who have been displaced, who are injured, who need to be transported to hospitals in other communities. And that's just sort of the immediate response. As you know, in these types of events, there are longer-term issues that, that we have to deal with, both in terms of health issues, rebuilding of homes, relocating people, and then the mental health effects of a storm like this, particularly for, say, the children in those schools that experience that horror.
Remind us of some of the impacts and recovery efforts that are going to be of a long-term nature for AmeriCares. And again, remind us that part of the mental health trauma for a community like this is that the effect of a storm of this power almost literally erases the community. People are so disoriented, they have no idea what street they're even standing on anymore.
Absolutely. So we're concerned particularly, obviously, about the people that are injured by the storm, but also about the disruption to the healthcare system. You've got people who have chronic diseases, chronic illnesses that rely on, you know, taking medicine every day, or they rely on assistive technology to get around, and they may have lost that medicine or lost access to those health services. In the coming days and weeks, you're going to see that as a mounting problem. In terms of mental health issues, studies have shown that, that one in four children that have been exposed to a trauma like a disaster such as this can experience post-traumatic stress symptoms months and years after the event. So that's another area that needs to be addressed, and we need there need to be interventions so that children can develop the coping skills to deal with this trauma.
So a disaster really compounded hour by hour as the needs of the community are clear and have to be met and become more and more urgent, both the people who are directly affected and those who are affected by the loss of infrastructure. Garrett Ingolia, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Garrett Ingolia is Vice President of Emergency Response from AmeriCares. In theory and practice, the press and government, I suppose, are meant to be antagonists. It is for this reason that the U.S. Constitution explicitly spells out, and the courts have subsequently strengthened, safeguards for the press and limits on the government's ability to monitor or curtail press activities. But Fox News correspondent James Rosen seems to have been the target of an encounter with government that shows just how many tools the authorities have at their disposal to track reporters and to identify the people who are talking to them. The Department of Justice reportedly tracked Rosen as he came and left the State Department using a security badge they gave him. They monitored his phone activity and got a warrant to look at his personal emails. David Sanger joins us, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars, and Surprising Use of American Power. David, welcome back.
Good to be back with you.
Now, you're not concerned that you're on some sort of Obama watch list there as a reporter for The Times, right?
Well, I'm not concerned about a watch list, but there are certainly investigations underway, including one that they've announced into the book you just described in the articles that I wrote from those. The things that they did with James Rosen in a case which actually goes back a few years now, you would expect them to do some of them, for example, looking at when he used his electronic badge to get in and out of the State Department and so forth. And we all move between the White House and the State Department and so forth and know that those movements are recorded electronically. I think what's most concerning is secretly going after subpoenaing email traffic without giving a news organization the opportunity to challenge that subpoena. Because under the Justice Department's own rules, they're only supposed to go after reporters' records, notes, or testimony after every other option has been exhausted.
And is this prior notification built into the Justice Department's guidelines, some sort of Supreme Court case law, that sort of thing?
It's built into their own guidelines after a number of cases that date back to the 70s. But these guidelines have emerged over the years, and they've got a few loopholes into them. And the AP case that we heard about last week involved the invocation of one of those exceptions, in which the Justice Department went off and obtained the call records of the number of AP bureaus and individuals, again, without notifying the AP and thus giving them a chance to challenge it.
Now, these exceptions seem to be related to national security issues. I'm wondering if what we're seeing here is an Obama administration attempting either explicitly or by default a kind of broad national security exclusion to the traditional First Amendment rights of the press that dates from essentially a 9/11 mission to try to figure out who might be talking to reporters and who might be related to terrorist networks of some kind around the world.
Well, that was certainly one of the big issues during the Bush administration. Look, national security reporting raises the most complex legal issues, and there are absolutists about it who say that there should be no balancing, the First Amendment should always rule. There are absolutists on the national security side who say, look, national security has to take precedence over any First Amendment rights. The reality is that when you look at the case law, it's a balancing act that goes on throughout most of the cases. The question here is, who do you want to have do that balancing? And if it's done entirely by the Justice Department, you know how the balance is going to sort out. It won't be much of a balance at all. Now, look, I do reporting for a living, and I do national security reporting for a living, but I can tell you that on the government side, there are people concerned that in the end, it's newspapers and news organizations that retain the sole rights over what in the end we decide to print, even if we get involved in lengthy negotiations with the government over what's truly dangerous or not. And most responsible news organizations do get involved in those talks over sensitive stories.
And we should note that once upon a time in the 20th century, a lot of big news organizations and the government were almost nearly in bed together in terms of sharing notes and talking to each other about various national security stories. That's really been one of the extraordinary changes over the last 3 to 4 decades.
It is. I mean, there's a famous story from New York Times lore that during the Bay of Pigs operation, the Times kept out of the paper a story that basically would have revealed the Bay of Pigs operation because it was an imminent operation. And President Kennedy later called up Scotty Reston, the New York Times bureau chief at the time, and said that invasion turned out to be the biggest mistake of his young presidency at that time, and he wished the Times would have run the story. He was more vivid about it than the way I just put it. So there was a very different era, and I think that the era that we've headed into is much healthier. That said, there are times when we withhold stories on national security grounds for a period of time. I held a story for 3 years about the covert American program to help secure Pakistan's nuclear weapons because the Bush administration made a convincing case that to advertise the vulnerabilities of Pakistan's weapons would have been to provide a roadmap for the Taliban to come in and grab them. We understood that. But there have been many other stories that we have not withheld or where we have just removed a few details that could have endangered somebody's life or an ongoing operation.
Finally, does the Rosen case smack of intimidation to you, or is there a specific sort of content issue in the balance here?
I think all these cases smack of intimidation, to some degree intimidating the reporters, but really trying to intimidate government officials and to make the case to government officials that they should never, ever be talking to reporters unless specifically authorized to. And that's what I think is most damaging. I think the second most damaging part is that it's eroding whatever channel of trust there was so that you can get involved in discussions with the government on a particularly sensitive story about what could truly be damaging. And keeping that channel open, I think, is quite vital if you're going to have a system where you have a free press and yet the government can make a case to delay some detail or not because it could endanger somebody's life.
Chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, David Sanger, is author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. David, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Financial news now. Decision day at J.P. Morgan Chase. Shareholders decided apparently to keep the boss, bank chairman and CEO Jamie Dimon. He will hold on to both of those titles. Shareholders voted against a proposal to split the two top jobs. Something of a theme today in the financial world. Can a management team's cleverness get them in trouble? Billions of dollars of troubled, clever trades last year over at J.P. Morgan is why shareholders were up in arms there. And at Apple, cleverness about avoiding taxes may be giving the company more unwanted publicity at a time when shareholders are already angry at Apple CEO Tim Cook over his unwillingness to hand over company cash in stock dividends. A congressional investigation into Apple's finances reveals that the tech company has avoided billions of dollars in taxes in the U.S. by setting up some of the company's top employees abroad, effectively making them exempt from U.S. taxes. With us now is Charles Herman, economics editor for WNYC Radio. They're so clever over there at Apple.
They're very clever. But it's not just Apple, you know. I think Apple, in a way, is a larger indication of problems in corporate America, the internationally global companies that are able to shift profits overseas and really take advantage of the corporate tax laws that exist in this company. And your accounting department basically becomes a cost center, a profit center, that if you know how to manipulate the laws and figure out how things work, you can make money.
And it's not just overseas. I mean, it's literally companies that existed only in the virtual world.
In the case of Apple, yeah. I mean, what this investigation is looking at is whether or not Apple created these subsidiaries, in particular Ireland, that in a way the committee, this permanent subcommittee in the Senate, said was in a way a stateless entity, that on the one hand, it wasn't really claiming to be in Ireland. You know, it wasn't based there, so it didn't really have to pay taxes there. But then at the same time, it wasn't really a U.S. company because the sales were happening in Ireland and was this sort of floating around. And again, the thing is that it doesn't appear that they have broken any particular law. What they have done is exploit the nature of not only U.S. law, but international law. And what Apple's CEO, who's going to testify today, is what he's really arguing is, let's have a bigger conversation about reforming corporate tax laws. The problem is, you know, it's like a balloon. You squeeze it one place, it's going to pop up somewhere else. The accountants are really clever, and they'll find ways to make money for the companies in ways that they can.
Well, he may want a bigger conversation, but when Tim Cook goes before the Senate, he's there before the Congress. I mean, he's going to get a lot of very nasty questions creating this corporate hologram over in Ireland.
And let's keep in mind, this is the same committee that, you know, hauled Lloyd Blankfein from Goldman Sachs in front of them. It's had J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon in front of them to talk about the trade that cost billions of dollars. I mean, this is a committee that
he took a hit. I mean, Dimon really suffered from public disparaging, and Cook's going to have some problems here.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a lot of theatrics that are going on here. This is going to be a big sort of explosive day, but whether or not, you know, 6 months down the road, a year down the road, we see substantial changes, I'm not sure. It's a much more complicated issue than just one hearing can resolve.
Cook did not show himself to be terribly sympathetic to shareholder concerns when he was confronted on the dividend question. How do you think he's going to just tonally respond to the U.S. Congress here? It's not his normal venue.
You know, it's a pretty – if you read the testimony, it is very sort of straightforward, like, no, we disagree. We didn't use tax gimmicks. We are perhaps the largest payer of taxes in the corporate company paying taxes in this company – in this country. We create jobs. You know, we've managed our money efficiently. We haven't done anything wrong. And again, the strongest line, I think, is like, we don't use gimmicks. So I don't think there's going to be in a tone of apology.
Will the share price take a hit?
But, you know, Apple's share has been a little bit wonky in general recently. It was going down somewhat of late, but it's still, you know, the most profitable tech company or most valued tech company that's out there. I don't think one hearing is going to have that effect.
Charles Herman, economics editor for WNYC Radio. Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
For much of the 2 years of deepening civil war in Syria, the fear has been whether the conflict would enlarge and become a regional chaos, pulling in Syria's neighbors. But so far, the region has been insulated from the violence of the conflict, if not the refugee influx, millions of refugees in Jordan and Turkey. But now the potential for how violence could be migrating across the border seems to be clarifying. Scenario one, around the city of Al-Qusair, near the Lebanese border, Hezbollah fighters seem to have entered the war in a big way, supporting President Bashar al-Assad. Many of those fighters came across the border from Lebanon. And scenario two, in neighboring Iraq, there's been an upsurge in sectarian bombings there. Some Sunni militia support the Syrian opposition and may be using the Syrian civil war as a pretext for attacking Shiite population centers in Iraq. Abigail Hausloner joins us now, Washington Post Cairo bureau chief. She's been reporting from Baghdad. Also with me is Tony Badrad, research fellow with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Tony and Abigail, welcome.
Thank you.
Good to be here.
So, Abigail, what do you make of these scenarios of an enlargement of the conflict in Syria? Do you think these are one-offs or is a pattern emerging?
Well, a lot of people would tell you that a pattern is emerging, and that's what, indeed, what many people on both sides of the sectarian divide in Iraq fear right now. What you have in Iraq is a very fragile, unstable foundation to begin with, and that's because after 10 years of U.S. occupation there, you have a government that's very divided, a Sunni minority there that's very unhappy with the Shiite-dominated government under Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, and then you have a Shiite majority that is now largely in power that was once repressed under Saddam Hussein, and so you have basically a lot of unresolved sectarian tensions, and now Iraq's government and other groups in Iraq are looking to Syria, and they're seeing that that political dynamic might be upset, where you have a sort of a Shiite government in charge there that is being challenged by a Sunni majority rebel movement. And if that shifts sort of the power dynamic, that is going to have a big impact on Iraq, and everyone in Iraq sees that.
Let's look at the Lebanon side of the equation here. Tony Badrad, Syria has for years, for really decades, thought of the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon as part of its security zone. They don't occupy it anymore. But is Bashar al-Assad relying on forces within Lebanon to help bolster his regime?
I think that's the case. But it's important to look at this more broadly as a part of the Iranian axis in the region, right? So, I mean, Hezbollah is not an independent actor. It's the long arm of Iran. And Syria is a very critical node in that axis. So there's, on the one hand, Iran's deep involvement and very deep, you know, high stakes in making sure that the Assad regime survives. So as the regime's manpower diminishes in terms of its ability to control all of Syria, it has come to rely more and more on Hezbollah to be its sort of its western flank as it consolidates sort of a territory. So that zone from Damascus, Homs to the coast is now really the concentration of the Assad regime, which has essentially become sort of like an Alawite militia and another zone of influence for Iran on the Mediterranean.
Now, if Iran were to attempt to strengthen an actual base in that part of the world, I mean, the Israelis will not tolerate that at all. How constrained do you think Iran is? And by virtue of Iran being constrained, is Bashar al-Assad constrained?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the Iranians have been, especially since 2006, their doctrine changed, and they introduced sort of into their military doctrine the use of long-range ballistic missiles, both to their assets in Gaza as well as in Lebanon. Let's not forget that since 2008, Israel has targeted senior figures in this sort of proliferation network, from Tehran all the way to the Sudan, and it has hit convoys and it has hit weapons caches from Lebanon all the way to Iran for stuff going to Gaza. And the Iranians and Hezbollah have been very, very limited in their ability to retaliate.
Tony Badrad, research fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We also spoke with Abigail Hausloner, Washington Post Cairo bureau chief. We return now to our top story this hour, the devastation in Oklahoma and the communities around Oklahoma City. And the city of Moore, Oklahoma, which really we're seeing is something of a ground zero for tornado devastation, devastated in May of 1999. And of course, much worse devastation, it appears, from the tornadoes that came through last night. Joining us to help us understand what kind of a meteorological event occurred over the last 48 hours is Harold Brooks, a research meteorologist at the National Severe Storms Laboratory in Norman, Oklahoma. You're not far from Moore yourself. Harold Brooks, welcome.
It's good to be here.
So what kind of an event happened, and what is it about Moore that makes it so unlucky here or vulnerable?
Well, it was in the sense that any tornado outbreak and any violent tornado is a normal event. This is about as normal as it could be. We had a strong upper-level pattern in the atmosphere that led to the right kind of wind profiles. We had lots of low-level moisture, very high dew points yesterday, so lots of energy for the storms. And in that kind of an environment, you're more likely to get a violent tornado than any other environment. And as far as Moore's concerned, as best we can tell, they're just very unlucky. I mean, there's no reason to think that they're any more preferred than other places. There have been a few tornadoes that have hit just south of here, and where I live in Norman, in the vicinity, that if they'd been moved by maybe 5 miles in their path, you know, we could have had very high death tolls out of those, and those have been in the last 3 or 4 years.
And this unlucky really is the proper characterization, because in the terrain out there, there's nothing really to channel the wind in any predictable way once it gets going.
Well, yeah, and really, in reality, the tornadoes don't particularly care very much about topography. We've had tornadoes that have crossed the Continental Divide, and so that's not a real big deal. And the thunderstorm itself is drawing air in from a very large area, and you know those storms are, you know, get to be 60,000 feet tall, so they're not all that concerned about small-scale features like terrain.
Is there anything about the energy in this storm, in the pattern of clusters of tornadoes that moves us an order of magnitude or any level of magnitude beyond the traditional baseline of storms in Oklahoma? Is the climate having an influence here at all?
We can't tell if there's any impact of climate change on tornado occurrence. There may be a slight, there may be an increase in the variability of occurrence. That's something we're actually actively studying right now. But in terms of the intensity, no. And we don't really have any expectations for a change in intensity in the future. Our understanding of how the climate's going to affect the environments is that one of the ingredients, the energy associated with available for storms, will increase, but that the wind shear, which organizes the storms and which tends to control the intensity more, will actually decrease. And so we've got one variable that'll be becoming more favorable for tornadoes and another will be becoming less favorable. And the balance is really hard to pick out.
Can you tell me what went through your mind when you looked at the radar photos, the indications of the data around Moore, and then the pictures?
Well, I mean, yeah, yesterday, we've known since last Wednesday that there was a chance of a tornado outbreak either on Sunday and yesterday in this vicinity. And yesterday, from the forecast yesterday, we knew that it was going to be very, very close. I was, in fact, quite concerned about my daughter, who is at home from university at our house, and making sure she was okay. And I didn't see the tornado from my office window. I could see the storm go up and watch it at that point. And it was one of those, you know, with where it was, what it was expected to do. You know, if you'd asked me at 10 o'clock in the morning if a storm forms west of the Oklahoma City metropolitan area, what's going to happen? It would have been we'd have a really big problem. And the real question was, would it be the northern part of the city, the southern part of the city, Norman, or a little bit further south? And it ended up being Moore.
Harold Brooks, research meteorologist at the National Severe Storms Laboratory. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
He's close to where the storm wreaked its worst havoc. He's in Norman, Oklahoma, not far from Moore. Michael Cross joins us now, state capitol reporter for KOSU in Oklahoma City. Michael Cross, your thoughts, what is your sense of what the state is dealing with right now?
Hello, John. You know, I think the state is dealing with many of the things that it did 14 years ago when another tornado tore through some of the same parts of Oklahoma and Moore. It was at that time considered an EF5, one of the first EF5s ever on record, and it killed 44 people, and it took months. It took months before everything got back to normal. Parts of Moore, the new parts that it went through, including the Warren Theater, are a result of kind of having to recover from that devastation 14 years ago. The Warren Theater was brand new. It was exciting. Everybody loved it. And just when I went by it yesterday with the governor, it was it was devastated. And there was debris everywhere when I went through last night, and people walking around in a daze. It was just a surreal experience.
I imagine that given the recent memory, the fresh memory of the 1999 tornadoes, which I can even remember covering that it affects the rebuilding effort. It gives a sort of ghostly quality to whatever mission going forward to basically make Moore the way it was before.
Yes, it's almost, there is a sense of almost PTSD. You get the feeling of having to redo it all over again. But I think there is also the ability to look at that and go, okay, we've done it before. And that's what the Moore city manager said last night at the press conference was, you know, we've rebuilt before and we will. We're a resilient people. And the outpouring here in Oklahoma has been amazing. Every you know, I follow Twitter and everybody is tweeting out, here's where you can go to drop off cash or checks or items that they need or things that the first responders need. Oklahomans are always willing to lend a helping hand, and these first responders have really shown that they can do great things. And especially now that we're finding out that the death toll might have decreased a little bit from what they were saying yesterday, and I think that just shows that more people are the first responders are able to get out there, not only from what they learned in May 3rd, 1999, but what they learned in the bombing of 1995. I think all of this comes together to say, and also the several tragedies we've had, ice storms, and we're no strangers, especially natural disasters. So I think that we're used to that, and we know how to immediately pick up and start getting to work, getting things done.
Well, and there's a real lesson from the people of Oklahoma to the rest of the people in the United States to be really serious about those first responder networks and those early warning networks. And that's something you're experiencing right now. Yes, Michael?
Exactly, John. It's been amazing to watch the outpouring of love and support and the work that the people here are doing.
All right. Michael Cross, State Capitol reporter for KOSU in Oklahoma. Oklahoma City, of course, the center of, again, a natural disaster that may break all records. Michael was referring to the tornadoes that took place in 1999, where more than 40 people were killed. The death toll unclear at this point. The president expected to speak shortly on this devastation in Oklahoma City. We've been following the aftermath of the tornado. For our listeners in Oklahoma, we always want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can post a comment at thetakeaway.org. Lyndon Dees writes on our Facebook page, here in Stillwater, we've been spared from nature's fury. Still greatly saddened, though. I'll be taking some needed items to the drop-off points in town to help survivors on the recovery crews. I wish there was more I could do. There is a lot that can be done in Oklahoma. Very much experienced to dealing with these kinds of recovery and response efforts. Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. We go out on a somber note. Riders on the Storm, certainly germane to the events of today, but also allowing us to remember Ray Manzarek, keyboard player and co-founder of The Doors, who died after a long battle with cancer. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.